chicago.edu/how.
And we have a short traffic alert for you. Eastbound I-4 is completely blocked at mile mark 12. This is in eastern Hillsborough County near Sefner due to a rollover crash. So once again, if you're traveling eastbound on I-4, it's completely blocked at mile marker 12 near Sefner because of a rollover crash. That's in eastern Hillsborough County. Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Later on in the program, we're going to be doing some fact-checking with a staff writer at PolitiFact. On the first part of the program, we're going to talk about the problem of inequality in the U.S. and how to overcome it. It's some of the worst inequality in the world is right here in the U.S. We'll talk about that in a moment. First, four listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, towards the end of the program, we got a call from a listener who said that he did not trust the Parkland students. He said that they were being manipulated by adults. Here's what four listeners had to say.
This is Mike in Bradenton. I wanted to respond to Fred Rico, who just called your show and said that he thought that the Parkland kids were being manipulated by the left and that he didn't see any connection between gun violence and legislation regarding gun safety. Gosh, I just don't know what to say, sir. I mean, if you just look at the sheer numbers, the raw data, the actual facts out there, the United States is awash in gun violence, and it's not video games. You know, there's a lot of other countries where the kids are watching the same video games and same movies, and there's not an explosion of gun violence happening because those guns, they're restricted, and not everyone can get them as easily as they can in the United States. I mean, 30,000 people in this country die from gun violence every year. That's a Vietnam every 2 years that's self-inflicted. So I would encourage you to be less concerned about your rights, especially considering you're not part of a well-regulated militia who's firing muskets. Just please try to go educate yourself on the reality of the problem that we're facing, and you'll understand that these kids are upset because they saw their friends get murdered in violent fashion right in front of their eyes. And I don't think they're being manipulated by anybody. Maybe if you saw a bunch of people you cared about gunned down in what seemed like a pointless exercise in gun violence, maybe you'd feel the same way.
This is Lila Lilliquist in Brandon, Florida. I just wanted to make a statement. It's only been since 1999 that the kids started getting the essential fatty acids for their brains. And there's a heightened awareness with that. And from 1970 to 1999, it was the age of the pharmacopoeia or pharmaceutical industry coming to the forefront with drugs like ADHD medication, antidepressants, opiates, drugs. Perhaps this is an awakening of consciousness in our society toward doing the right thing. I'm just so thankful the kids are waking up. We need salvation in this country, and we need the kids to be clear-headed without drugs and going forward with leadership.
My name is Cork from Sarasota. If people will look at the Constitution under the powers that are granted to Congress, one of them is to organize a militia. It's capitalized M for militia, same as it is capitalized militia in the Second Amendment. So it means that Congress is the one who organizes this well-regulated militia. And there's a fellow that thought that maybe the left had organized these Parkland students, influenced them. Well, there could be. But what about the right? The right's doing that a lot, so the world is the world.
This is Teresa. I have a message for all the Bernie supporters. I, too, was a Bernie supporter. I voted for him in the primary, and I wanted him bad. And I was angry, just like the rest of you, about what happened to him. But the one thing I did know is I didn't trust Trump at all and only trusted Hillary probably about 60%. But I trusted Bernie, and when Bernie said we needed to support Hillary and vote for her so we had a better chance of getting our agenda to happen, and so I said, you know what, I trust Bernie, that's what he wants us to do, That's what I thought we all should have did. So I did it. I went in, voted for Hillary, whether I wanted to or not, because he knew that this guy in the White House we have now is destroying our country. So all you people that couldn't get over the fact that Bernie got screwed, just screwed our country into, I don't know what, maybe into nuclear annihilation. I don't know. So I hope you all can live with yourself. Try to have a good day.
Some listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. Our next guest is an activist and a journalist, and he recently wrote, over the last 37 years, the top 10% of all Americans saw their incomes rise by 115%, and the top 1% saw an incredible rise of 198%. Meanwhile, the bottom half of all American earners failed to see any gain at all. Their incomes actually declined by 1% from 1978 to 2015. Our guest writes that extreme inequality and related social deterioration fueled both the Bernie Sanders and the Donald Trump campaigns. We're going to speak now with Les Leopold, who's a co-founder of the Labor Institute. He wrote a book called Runaway Inequality recently. He'll be speaking in St. Petersburg this Sunday afternoon, and I asked him about his book, Runaway Inequality. Les Leopold, welcome back to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me again.
I want to ask you about your book, Runaway Inequality. What's the premise of the book?
The premise of the book is that almost all the problems that we care most about have a connection, that they're connected to each other through what's been going on for the last 40 years in our economy, which is ever-increasing inequality between the top 1% or even less than 1%. And virtually everyone else. And so the book is designed to help us have that picture in our heads and the data to back it up, and then to explore issue by issue by issue to show how they're connected, and then hopefully help us have a discussion about where we go from here. We believe that this kind of education that's embodied in the book, and we're trying to build a whole education network across the country through a website we've put together called runawayinequality.org, we're trying to develop thousands of trainers that can go all around the country and help people understand the big picture, how the many problems that hit us separately are deeply, deeply connected.
All right. Well, when you talk about inequality, I mean, hasn't the U.S. and hasn't the world always had inequality we're just having a temporary shift where things like automation or the changing job world, changes in globalization, that those are temporary things and that, you know, we'll fix this sometime soon.
Well, you know, that's kind of what I thought. And as I started to dive into this, I realized that two things are very important to grasp. Number one is that the current the last 40 years of runaway inequality is like nothing we've ever seen, ever, in the U.S. economy. It's dramatically different from the way the economy ran between 1945 and, let's say, 1980. Look, there's always been inequality in American life. There's always been millionaires and such that lived completely differently. But the number of them and the amount that they're getting, the gap, is much greater. So let me give you an example. In 1970, the gap between top CEO and the average worker was about 45 to 1. Today, it's for this decade, it's been 800 to 1. That's a pretty big increase. So something has dramatically changed. So what is it? That was leading to the second part of what you were talking about. We hear a lot about automation and globalization as being the drivers, and that once this all settles down, we'll see inequality go back to sort of its historical levels. In fact, very good studies have been done on those causes, automation and globalization, and those are very minor causes of runaway inequality. The largest cause is something that is called financialization, or what we call financial strip mining, which is the massive increase in the size and power of Wall Street-type operations in the American economy. That's what has changed. And that's what's not going to go back to the way it was without a big fight. So there's nothing, there's no magic pendulum in the economy that swings back and that's going to swing back towards more fairness and equality back the way it was in the 60s and 50s, 60s, and 70s. We're not going to go back to that on its own.
So about 1980, things changed. Could you talk about the 1%? How has the 1% done since 1980? And how has the bottom 50% done since 1980?
Well, it's interesting. We can show quite clearly that the top 1% has done fabulously well. Ever-increasing standard of living in real buying power from late 1970s all the way till today. The average working person in America, there's your 50%, has actually seen the real buying power of their wages decline since 1977. In other words, the American working person has not had a raise in 40 years in real buying power. And that's what's kind of hollowing out our economy. And in fact, I think that's what's leading to both the reaction from the right and from the left. I think the anger that people are feeling in rural America, being left behind, seeing their factories close, having their kids have a difficult time making their way in the world, seeing that whole idea that your kids are going to do better than you, seeing that collapse. I think that's fueling the reaction to the right that Trump, I think, picked up on, but also I think Bernie Sanders picked up on that. And Sanders was clearly attacking runaway inequality. So I think it's an incredibly, incredibly deep problem now, and that we have to address it. It's not going to go away by itself.
We're talking with Les Leopold. He's the executive director of the Labor Institute and the author of the book Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Issues. So, Les, could you say, though, that if you look at all the developed world, whether it's Western Europe or whether it's Japan or Canada and the U.S., that we all have, all these countries have similar levels of inequality?
No, they don't. They all have inequality. But we're way out ahead. We're way number one. We lead the world in inequality by a factor of five. No other country comes close to what we have because we have the most financial strip mining. We've let Wall Street run wild in this country, much more wild than they can run in other countries. So the gap is much smaller in Northern Europe. The Scandinavian countries have a compressed income gap. They have much less poverty. They have their students are far less in debt. They have, you know, universal health care. They have a lot of things that help working people that we don't have. So it's not like we can get no comfort from thinking that the whole world is going in this direction. We are going in that direction. If anything, we're pulling the world in that direction because we let Wall Street run wild. And I think the American people sense that there is something terribly unfair when Wall Street crashed the economy in 2007. 8 million people got unemployed due to no fault of their own. Then we bail out Wall Street, and they're at it again. They're just making money hand over fist, and they're getting more deregulated, and inequality will just continue.
Well,
increasing inequality.
You mentioned financial strip mining on the part of Wall Street. What does that mean? What does it mean to financial strip mining?
What started to happen after 1980, Wall Street saw that politicians were pushing deregulation, and they kind of drove a truck through the opening that they got. And it allowed them to buy up a lot of companies with borrowed money. That was new. And then extract wealth from those companies rapidly. And if the company collapsed afterwards, they didn't care. They did the same thing with students. Student loans are now one of the biggest areas of debt in the whole economy. So families and students are being financially strip mined by paying all the interest and principal and the fees that go with that. Communities have the way the tax system now is set up is the corporations have their contribution to state and local government taxes have gone down. Wealthy people have moved a lot of their money offshore. And as a result, there's not enough money to make ends meet on a community level. So what do communities do? They have to take out bonds via Wall Street, and they pay enormous fees for those bonds. The fees paid by L.A., Los Angeles, alone, just for their bonds, not principal and interest, just the fees, is twice their budget for maintaining and repairing their streets and roads. So that's financial strip mining. It's moving money, wealth, from corporations, productive corporations, from families, from communities, into the hands of the very few. And that process has to stop, or we're going to be hollowed out.
So when we hear about a company, a corporate raider buying up a company, and it has a lot of different branches, and the corporate raider sells off the most profitable parts of that company, maybe they have a mine, or maybe they own a record company that's profitable, and they sell it off, but then they saddle the rest of the company with debt, is that financial strip mining?
That's part of it. That's a big part. Look at Toys R Us. Toys R Us was saddled with a $5 billion debt that it's been unable to pay. But the wealth has now been extracted from that company. The people who did the deal, they're gone. Another big thing is this thing called stock buybacks. They changed the way CEOs were paid. Back in 1980, a CEO got 85 to 90% of its pay were salary and bonuses, and only 5% were stock incentives. Now it's completely reversed. Only 5% are salary and bonuses, and the rest are stock incentives. Well, before 1982, it was illegal to take the company's money and go into the stock market and bid up the price of your own stock and reduce the number of owners, and therefore the value of the stock goes up. That was illegal. That was considered stock manipulation, but they deregulated in 1982 under the Reagan administration. It was just a rule change, and now companies spend upwards to 60-70% of all corporate profits go to stock buybacks. Why? Because the CEO gets paid that way, and the top investors get paid that way. So financial strip mining becomes like a laser of stock buybacks, and almost every company that you see is in trouble, you'll find that it has a history of these big stock buybacks. So instead of reinvesting the money in the company into R&D, into worker training, into environmental controls and health and safety, the money goes to stock buybacks. It's actually, if you want to characterize what's new about American capitalism right now, you would say its primary mission is to get cash flow to do stock buybacks. That's what they think about every single day. How do you get the cash flow to do stock buybacks to enrich the CEOs and the top investors?
And how did
that is a pernicious formula.
How did the tax cuts last year that were passed by Congress and okayed, signed by President Trump, how does that play into stock buybacks?
Well, it's very interesting. Since the signing, there have been about $5 billion in increases in salaries and bonuses of workers. There's been $178 billion in stock buybacks so far. This year is expected to be a record year of over $800 billion in stock buybacks. That's money that's going to go from the corporation to the top investors. A disaster in those terms. That money's not going to go back and reinvest it. And you know what? We knew this was going to happen. In 2004, Bush did a tax holiday to bring money back from overseas, and $200 billion came back overseas. And a very great study, very interesting study was done by an MIT researcher with Harvard, and a Harvard researcher and a Northwestern researcher, and they found that for every $1 that came back from overseas, 61 to 92 cents of that dollar ended up going to the stockholders and the corporate executives. So that's what the stack, you know, it's basically that every single piece of that, virtually every piece of that bill is going to increase inequality, even though there's, you know, something that working people may get out of it in the short run. Their tax breaks expire, or, you know, working people's tax breaks expire. The corporate tax breaks go on indefinitely. And stock buybacks will be a banner year, absolute banner year.
So the money isn't invested in factories. It doesn't go to hiring more workers or anything like that. It goes to the shareholders.
Exactly. And the opposite takes place. R&D is cut. Workers are laid off. All the things that can increase production moved abroad, cuts in healthcare benefits, increased copays. All that is part of the process of generating cash flow so that they can go into the marketplace and buy back their own shares. Think about it. If 95% of your pay came from stock incentives, what are you going to do when you go to work every day? You're going to be thinking about how to raise the price of the stock, and the surest way to do it is through stock buybacks, not the more patient 1950s, 60s process of reinvesting in your product, building up R&D, training your workers. All that's, passe now. Now what you do is you buy back your shares.
We're talking with Les Leopold. He's going to be speaking at the Temple Beth El at 400 Pasadena Avenue South in St. Petersburg this coming Sunday at 4:30 in the afternoon. His book is Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. During the campaign, Donald Trump frequently criticized Hillary Clinton as being a tool of Wall Street. He promised to, in some of his ads, he promised to go after Wall Street. And then in the last year and a half or so, a lot of pictures have been taken of President Trump standing alongside people in hard hats, standing alongside coal miners, standing alongside workers. Has President Trump done anything to curtail the power of Wall Street?
No. Matter of fact, the opposite. He's encouraging more and more deregulation. They're going to gut Dodd-Frank, which wasn't all that great to begin with in curbing Wall Street. And they're going to make it easier for Wall Street to extract wealth from the rest of the economy. He appointed enormous number of Wall Street bankers to various positions in his government. So, look, whatever you think of President Trump, he's a showman. And it made good politics for him to attack Clinton. Clinton did a lot of stupid things in terms of taking money for Wall Street for outrageous amounts for speeches. He seized on that. He played it up. And he knew there'd be a receptive audience because the American people don't like Wall Street. But, in practice, he's totally in line with their interests. He's not doing anything to curb their power, and he's doing nothing to curb runaway inequality. I think that's going to come back to haunt them in a big way, assuming that the Democrats jump on it at some point.
Now, during the 2016 election, a lot of people were in play. A lot of voters were in play. I've looked at some numbers that suggest that from 2008 to 2016, about 7 million people who voted for President Obama ended up voting for Donald Trump in 2016. So they voted for Obama in 2008, and then in 2016, they voted for President Trump. Have you seen similar numbers?
And
do you
think,
are there a lot of voters in play? And talk about that for a moment.
Well, actually, the three key states that flipped, Michigan, 500,000 of those Obama voters switched to Trump. 222,000 in Wisconsin, 290,000 plus in Pennsylvania. That was the election right there. And I think if you look more closely at those voters, they probably were Obama, Sanders, Trump. They didn't go with the standard bearer of the Democratic Party because that standard bearer and a lot of the Democrats, in fact, are corporate Democrats and are not that concerned about runaway inequality. They were not speaking to that issue. They were not taking on Wall Street. They were not attacking financial strip mining. I do a lot of talks all over the country with working people, steel workers, the kind of people you see Trump, bringing up on for his photo ops. And more than one, countless actually said to me, "You know what? I think I'm going to vote for Trump just to shake things up because it was like a protest vote. I can't stand this anymore. We're getting screwed by the Democrats, except for Bernie. And I want to try to do something about it." And so I think you're right. I haven't seen the 7 million number, but I've seen it broken down in those three states. I think you're absolutely right. Those voters are in play. And that's why what I'm doing, I'm not just going around, doing these education programs. I'm really fortunate to be invited all over the country to do this. I am trying to recruit lay trainers, not trained economists, but lay trainers on our website, runawayinequality.org. We have a curriculum. We train people how to use it to run from 2 to 8 hour workshops. And we've got about 500 trainers. We'd like to get about 5,000 trainers. to help people understand what's going on so they can think more clearly about what they want to see happen and pressure their elected representatives and people running to do something about runaway inequality. We've been having incredible success with that, and people just go to our website and they sign up, and then we try to set up a trainer process. All the money from this book, and the book is doing really well, goes back into that process. I'm not taking any personal royalties out of this, and we've gotten in circulation 50,000 copies. We're printing another 10,000, so we're doing very well to support this education program. That's what I'm really about, trying to recruit people into this army of educators, the way the populists did back in the 1880s and 1890s, the progressive populists. That's how they built their movement, through an army of educators. I think we need a reversing runaway inequality movement. That's what I'm, in this part of my life, that's what I'm designed to do, is to help set up that kind of movement.
Les Leopold is the author of Runaway Inequality, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. All right, so how do you combine these folks? Because if President Trump is saying to coal miners, look, I'm going to bring your jobs back, and if he's saying to steel workers, I'm going to put tariffs on imported steel, how do you combine that group that used to be a bedrock part of the progressive movement or the Democratic movement? How do you combine union members who might have been disaffected with groups that support Planned Parenthood, the right to choose, women's equality and fair pay for
great
women,
immigrants,
Medicaid recipients, and environmentalists who would be the main ones that would oppose the coal miners?
Well, look, you just frame the question. What we're trying to do is we're trying to help all those groups see that they have a common problem with runaway inequality. We talk to environmentalists and we go, how's it going? How is your strategy of focusing only on climate change working out? Well, you got a denier as president pulling out, got deniers all over the government. We pulled out of the Paris Accords. All the standards are being weakened. How much worse can it be? Isn't it time to maybe reconsider your approach? And I say this to all the different groups, maybe we need to be on the same page. Let me tell you about one thing we got going. We got steel workers, communication workers, and Sierra Club members in the Bay Area of California. We got them together for a day and a half workshop at an oil refinery, local union hall in Martinez, California, out of which they said, please train us as trainers in your curriculum. And we now have trained 20 of them to work in pairs, labor and environment pairs, to go out and talk about runaway inequality. So one of the things that came up in the training is they realized, you know what? Maybe it's not a good idea to shut down California refineries because we've got 50 million or so cars that still need gasoline. We're going to have to then import that gasoline from Asia, and there's going to be produced under less stringent controls with a bigger carbon footprint, putting it on ships and bringing it over. Maybe it's smarter to work with a highly regulated workforce in California and just have safer refineries while we make the transition away from fossil fuels. That conversation actually worked with these people. So if you see what's great about education, what's different from, social media or, just movies and stuff like that, when you bring people live together in a safe space, like at this union hall, when we have the Sierra Club members come in, you could have really good, honest discussions. People treat each other with respect. We have this kind of non-lecture training methodology where people really are engaged in small group discussion. It's a powerful, powerful way to start building that common agenda. And what we're calling on is you need a common agenda to take on runaway inequality that includes environmental issues, women issues, immigration issues, labor issues. But each of those issues, we have to get people to come out of their issue silos. They have to make their silos more porous. They have to see that they need a common movement. Otherwise, all these individual movements will continue to lose. They're all losing. And even the steelworkers know that they're going to, on a lot of other fronts, their health and safety is deteriorating. I just came from a big steelworker concert. It's 1,600 health and safety folks. They have a lot of concerns from deregulation. So they know that they need a common agenda. And we have to help them to see that all these issues are interrelated and that the power comes, as your question suggested, the power comes when all these groups start to see what they have in common through approaching a way to reverse runaway inequality. We're having really good luck with that idea of breaking out of your silos. That's what we're trying to do with this education.
Les, those were all the questions I was going to ask you, and we're kind of running out of time, but is there anything else regarding your book and your visit to St. Petersburg this coming Sunday? Is there anything else you want to tell us?
Go to runawayinequality.org. Sign up for being a trainer. We'll never try to raise money from you. You get on the mailing list, and you'll really love becoming a runaway inequality trainer. We can promise you that. That's my message.
Les Leopold, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Thank you so much for having me.
Les Leopold is the executive director of the Labor Institute. He's based in the New York City area, and his latest book is called Runaway Inequality. He'll be speaking this Sunday at 4:30 in the afternoon at Temple Beth El, which is at 400 Pasadena Avenue South in St. Petersburg. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. I'm Rob Lurie. This is Radioactivity, and we're going to do some fact-checking right now with Allison Graves, who's a staff writer at PolitiFact, which is now part of the Poynter Institute. It was founded by the Tampa Bay Times, won a Pulitzer Prize a few years ago, and is now part of the nonprofit Poynter Institute. And Allison, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to ask you, there have been so many interesting things, especially since the Parkland shooting, that I thought that we should talk about. And I'm going to go through some of the recent Florida PolitiFact fact checks with you right now. And but Allison, could I ask you, before we start, what the first step is when you're fact-checking something as a staff writer at PolitiFact, and you see something that you think may or may not be true, what's the first thing you do?
The first thing we do is reach out to the speaker. And, you know, in some cases, in the cases of fake news, the speaker is usually bloggers or posts on the internet, so there isn't a direct contact. But in most cases, our first step is always to reach out to the speaker to hear what their evidence is for the claim. Then, you know, I just start with a simple Google search, and I expand my research from there.
And everybody asks this, I'm sure. How do you know what you're getting on Google is solid information? How do you judge the wheat from the chaff, so to speak?
So I think it's just using a lot of common sense practices when you're looking at articles, looking at the URL where it's coming from, and kind of just having a real or just knowing what news websites are credible and which ones aren't, and also just looking to see if what's being reported in one place is also being reported elsewhere. And as always, if, you know, the Google search isn't enough, there's public records, there's interviews we do with experts that really can nail down a point beyond what we're just seeing on Google.
So let's start with a fact-checking a picture that's floating on the internet. It shows one of the Parkland students, Emma Gonzalez, who gave a really powerful speech a few days after the shooting. But it shows her, a picture on the internet shows her ripping up the Constitution. What can you tell us about that?
So that photo is doctored, and we rated this claim pants on fire. So shortly after the March for Our Lives events on March 24th, we started seeing this image of Emma Gonzalez and GIF of Gonzalez tearing down the middle of the U.S. Constitution. But it wasn't short. It was not too long after that a lot of Twitter users started to point out that the images were doctored and photoshopped. So the original image was actually taken from a video by Teen Vogue, and Gonzalez is actually ripping up a gun range target poster. So people on the internet have photoshopped the Constitution over that gun range target poster to make these claims. But there's just no truth to them. Like I said, in the real video, Gonzalez is ripping up a gun target. And even some of the Twitter accounts sharing these false images were suspended after the post. But even after the post had kind of been debunked, a lot of people were sharing it in the name of satire. So we wanted to make sure that we made it clear that any photos or GIFs you see of Emma Gonzalez ripping up the Constitution are not true. They are doctored images.
Allison, is there a way for the public to do this research themselves? For instance, can you take the photo of Emma Gonzalez and somehow do a Google search or some other sort of search and find the original undoctored photo?
So for this check, we were able to see other people's reactions to the Photoshop. But there's a Google reverse image search. So if you were to have put in the image of Gonzalez maybe ripping up the Constitution, what you would have seen is the Teen Vogue article more than likely would have popped up. And looking at the Teen Vogue article, you can clearly see that the actual image is the gun range target poster. And beyond just that reverse Google image search, just looking at Twitter and looking at the replies to the tweets showing maybe a questionable image really do give you a good indication of whether or not it's true.
All right. And I didn't know that Google reverse image searches were possible. I learned something right there. Thanks for telling me that and all of us that. Yeah. Okay. So let's stick with the Parkland shooting for a moment. David Hogg, the young male student who's become quite a spokesperson for the Parkland student and their cause. There are some on the internet who are suggesting that he wasn't even at the school during the shooting. What can you tell us about that?
So this claims that he was not at the school are also pants on fire. So the inaccurate claim surfaced after CBS News produced a 39 Days, which was a documentary of several Stoneman Douglas High School students, including Hogg. And at the beginning of the video, Hogg described, as a student journalist, explains his actions following the shooting that left 17 people dead. And so in that excerpt, he kind of talks about going home to get his camera. And he says, on the day of the shooting, I got my camera, I got on my bike and rode as fast as I could 3 miles from my house to the school to get as much video and as much interviews. And so a lot of people question how Hogg could be at school, how he could leave school and come back if the school was on lockdown. And they just were really poking holes in the timeline. And those people raising concerns about the timeline led to these bloggers just picking up the story and saying that he just wasn't there. And that's just not true. The timeline, it presented in the way that you'll see some of these bloggers do, it is confusing. But really, Hogg was at the school during the shooting, and there's even a video that he shot on his cell phone while taking cover in the classroom closet. So, like I said, the claims that he wasn't there are just not based on any evidence.
And just to recap, so he was at the school, he left the school, and then went back after he picked up his camera at home.
Well, he took cover when the shooting happened, but it wasn't until 6:30 p.m. that he actually got on his bike with his camera from home and rode back to the campus area. He wasn't allowed back on campus around 6 because they were still on lockdown, but he had gone home for the day, and then the part where he's talking about grabbing his camera to get interviews is actually when he's returning back to the area later at night.
Okay, I got you. All right. Another question about guns. Senator Marco Rubio, there's a lot of suggestion that, we ban assault weapons. Senator Marco Rubio said at the end of February that under New York State's assault weapons ban, one simple cosmetic change is the difference between legal and banned. I think Senator Rubio was suggesting that it's hard to write an assault weapons ban. What did the senator say? Maybe you could straighten me out here. What did the senator say, and what did you find?
So the tweet came as Rubio's response to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who said that earlier in the day that Rubio should be ashamed of himself for not supporting stricter gun control legislation. So during a CNN town hall the night before, Rubio signaled for support for raising the age to buy a rifle or shotgun to 21 and for tighter background checks. But he also stated that, yes, banning or just a blanket ban on assault weapons is difficult because there are simple cosmetic changes that result in a gun being legal or banned. So in reality, he's right. So in this specific image he shared on Twitter, this image shows a pistol grip, and pistol grips have been banned on rifles in New York State since 2013. And it's one of the several features banned by the New York Secure Ammunition and Firearms Enforcement Act, that's otherwise known as the SAFE Act. But he does have a point that one simple cosmetic change is the difference between a gun being legal or banned. And that was just to draw on the point that a blanket ban on assault rifles is going to be difficult going forward.
That's going to be difficult to achieve, to write it, to encompass everything, if that's where we're headed. Well, we're talking with Allison Graves, who is a staff writer at PolitiFact, which is now part of the Poynter Institute, and it's now a nonprofit as opposed to being part of the Tampa Bay Times, which it was founded at. Allison, let's come back to Florida for a little bit and talk about some of the issues in the state capitol. We just had the end of the legislative session. And Governor Scott says that we have this year and in the past few years, he and the legislature have passed record amounts of funding for education. Is that true?
So there's a lot to sort out here. We ended up reading this half through. So Governor Rick Scott has a point in terms of sheer dollars. If you look from about fiscal year 2013-14 to 2018-2019, the funding for K through 12 and state university has increased every year. But the big caveat here is that Scott is really overstating the value of those dollars. The K through 12 education budget has not topped pre-recession levels when you adjust the numbers for inflation. So what I mean by that is if you look up the number for per pupil spending for 2018 and 2019, that is actually less than what it was in 2007 to 2008, which was right before the recession. So by just kind of looking at that six-year chunk, he's kind of leaving out a lot of the other picture, which is, of course, looking at the last 10 years of education funding.
All right. And Ron DeSantis, who's a congressman from the East Coast and really could be the dark horse candidate for governor, he's being attacked by his friends on the right. He's very conservative. He's a very conservative politician. But some people in the conservative movement are saying that he wants to give food stamps to immigrants. Is that right?
So we rated this claim pants on fire, too. So this website posted a story that, you know, made the claim that DeSantis voted in favor of food stamps for illegal immigrants. But the article fails to point out that even before the Farm Bill passed, which is the legislation they're pinpointing here, undocumented immigrants were already generally blocked from getting food stamps. This also messes up DeSantis' motivation for voting against the bill. He said that the section on immigration wasn't the motivation. At the time of the vote, his vote against the bill, he thought that it was a bad deal for taxpayers and failed to rein in the food stamp program. So by voting no, he was really taking a stand against the overall piece of legislation. And that's not really evidence that he voted in favor of food stamps for illegal immigrants. So everything considered here, we ended up rating this claim pants on fire.
And the website that first carried this claim that DeSantis was in favor of giving food stamp benefits to immigrants, what do you know about the website, or what can you tell us about the website?
So it's called Uncle Sam's Misguided Children, and it's a website that says it's a community founded by United States Marine veterans to bring awareness of the lamestream media. So that kind of gives you an indication of where they lie on the political spectrum. But this was definitely a website that maybe you wouldn't normally come across. It's not a CNN, New York Times type of website. And when you click on it and actually go to the article, you can really see how the website's laid out, how it is different than traditional news sources.
Allison, let me just ask you a question about websites in general, because that's where a lot of your fact-checking is done, when these websites post pictures or make statements on them. Is there a way for you at PolitiFact to tell who's funding the websites?
So I personally, I know our old PolitiFact Florida reporter, Josh Gillen, he made a list of all of these websites known to produce fake news. And there is a way to check the URL to see who is maybe created the website. But I don't know myself how to check who is funding it. But I definitely think we have resources on PolitiFact that at least go over the type of motivations that drive people to write these posts and why, you know, what their motivations are.
Because Ron DeSantis is very conservative. So for a conservative website to attack him from the right, just something doesn't sound right. But we can move on. We'll have enough campaign news here between now and the end of the between now and November. We'll be talking about it endlessly. One more question about guns before I let you go, Allison, and that is, I think a lot of people, and most recently, I think maybe it was a member of Congress, I forgot who said it, but they said that it's not a good idea to ban guns or anything because Hitler confiscated all the guns. Did Hitler confiscate all the guns as he rose to power in Germany in the 30s, in the 1930s?
So, no, that's not accurate. Reducing Nazi gun policy to confiscation of weapons misses a lot of the story. So Hitler was a giver and taker of weapons. So he did take weapons away from Jews, communists, and social democrats, but he also armed private citizens to better terrorize those same political opponents. We talked to a German historian who has gone through a lot of the records about Hitler, and that person said that Hitler drastically increased the number of privately held weapons. And on the confiscation side, she noted that the registry was limited and far from comprehensive. So really, the idea that Hitler confiscated all the guns, there's really so much more historical context to understand that, and it's just not an accurate claim.
So a lot of people still had guns in Hitler's Germany. It was just the people who were out of favor with Hitler, their guns were taken away.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. David Simmons, I think, made that. He's a state senator from Florida. All right. So, Allison, thank you so much. I noticed that there was one more thing that came up today on your website. And let me see if I can bring it up. I think it's the top issue on the Florida PolitiFact website. And I hadn't heard this. Let me just go to your website for a second. A group called, or maybe a website called, Fellowship of the Minds says that the application for the March for Our Lives, which took place two Saturdays ago, the application for the permit was made months before the Parkland shooting.
So we also rated this one pants on fire. I didn't write this one and I haven't read through it, but we contacted the police officer referred in the story who confirmed, and he told us that the story was inaccurate and the permit was actually issued 11 days prior to the march. So just another instance of not an accurate claim circulating. It was an internet hoax, actually.
All right. And people can read the citations on the website at the politifact.com website. Well, Allison Graves, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on WMNF and clearing up some of these latest things that are said on the internet and said politically. Thanks for clearing it up.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate the time.
All right, great. Thanks, Allison. Allison is a staff writer for PolitiFact, which is based at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm going to read some of these emails that have come in, but we're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. When I was doing the interview with Les Leopold, Charlie wrote this. He had a question. In today's gun climate, how is it that the two major U.S. gun manufacturers accrued so much debt that they filed for Chapter 11 protection? Charlie, I don't know, but I think that there are some good business writers who have written about that, and maybe we could look up some of those articles. Lori writes this regarding the voters who voted initially in 2008 for Barack Obama and then in 2016 voted for Donald Trump. Lori writes, so do those voters say they would have gone with Bernie? We're going to have to get a political scientist on who studied that, but it is a phenomenon out there that some of those early Barack Obama voters voted for Donald Trump. And we'll find out how big that number is. I said 7 million. I don't think that number is right. I think I misspoke. But there are some studies out there that suggest hundreds of thousands, if not more, people voted for Obama in 2008 and then later on voted for Donald Trump. I'll see if I can get the numbers. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Here's an unsigned email that says Donald Trump's poll numbers are on the rise to 50%. Yeah, The Rasmussen poll, on which that's based, is a reliably Republican-favoring poll and not usually considered a very reliable poll. It's always good news for Republicans when you read that poll. So, yeah, Rasmussen says that Donald Trump's approval numbers are at 50%. One place to look to see a better range of polls is to go to Real Clear Politics, and they'll give you the president's approval numbers. Rasmussen will be in there, but so will dozens of other polls. And Real Clear Politics takes the average of all those polls. So if you're curious about the president's current popularity numbers, you can go there. His popularity is probably somewhere in the mid to high 30s to the lower 40s. That's where he's at. Ernie writes this: I'm on the fence about whether or not to help educate people who are ignorant about guns yet have strong opinions against guns, writes Ernie in Port Richey. And Ernie, thanks for that. Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663, and our email address, dj@wmnf.org. Thanks to Bill Grace and Jan Simpson. They're both in the phone production room. Let's go to Chris in St. Pete. Chris, you're on. What would you like to say?
Well, I would love to have any news agencies off of the outside the internet, that is, comment on the official story being so contradicted by two teachers and two students of the Parkland shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, like teacher Ernest Rospierski and Stacy LaPell. Rospierski said that the school was having a scheduled code red drill where officers were going to be firing blanks, and he said the shooter had on a mask. Stacy LaPell said the shooter was wearing full metal body armor, a helmet, and a face mask. And these are all videos, by the way, that I've seen myself.
And Chris, you're one of our regular conspiracy theorist callers. Where are you getting your information from?
Well, as I said, videos I've seen myself, like the Associated Press, Ernest Rospierski, you can see the interview with him, Stacy LaPell on Good Morning America, Matt Musil, a KHOU reporter, interviewed student Alexa Meadnick, who said she was speaking with Nicholas Cruz as the shooting was happening. She made no mention of him with a mask or other garb.
So, well, Chris, I can do a fact check right now. If you just give me the spelling, because I've checked, I don't have the right spelling for Ernest Rospierski. Nothing comes up. But how do you spell Ernest Rospierski?
Ernest, E-R-N-E-S-T, right. Rospierski is R-O-S-P-I-E-R-S-K-I, and Stacy LaPell.
And you said that he was quoted in the Associated Press?
In a video that the AP, yes, the AP has on their own YouTube channel. Yeah. And,
well, you know, frequently what happens, you know, you're a big fan of InfoWars, right?
Oh, no, I used to be, because now that they've started...
Because I've looked on your website, and you link to InfoWars.
On my website?
Yeah. The one you give out every time you call.
Well, that's an organization I belong to.
Right, but every time you give out your organization, you link to InfoWars. The Miami Herald has a really good article about Ernest Rospierski, and let me just encourage people to look at it. It's dated February 14th, and the headline is, this teacher thought it was a drill but then heard shooting. He kept students safe. And I'll just read a little bit from the Miami Herald. When the firearm alarm rang near the end of the school day on Wednesday at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, teacher Ernest Rospierski assumed it was a code red drill. Earlier that day at a staff meeting, teachers had been told that there soon would be a code red or lockdown drill, in which teachers and students practiced their response to an immediate threat, but they hadn't been told the date. Rospierski was sitting at his desk around 2:25 p.m. when the fire alarm rang. His students filed out of their third floor classroom and made their way down the stairs. Then Rospierski heard the sound of gunfire. So people can look up that article. He doesn't, I don't see where it says that he said that rounds of ammunition, blank rounds, were going to be fired. I don't see any of that in this article.
Yeah, Rob, you ought to just watch the video. Maybe you want to play it on your air and see what others might have to say about it, because I know you haven't had the time to listen to it.
Well, Chris, I go to InfoWars a lot. You know, in fact, every day I go to InfoWars, and what happens is that when I go to the original source, InfoWars has turned things around and made it seem worse than it is. I'll just give you one example. InfoWars said just a few days ago, and I played the sound on the air, that North Korea was going to attack Japan at the very end of March. And what's his name? Alex Jones was just about to pop a artery. He was so upset. But we can debate InfoWars anytime. If you want to, and Chris, thanks a lot. Thanks for your call. Great to hear from you. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. I'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. And stay tuned for your hero, Mark Biro. This is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg.